Great. Thank you very much to the organizers and to our sponsors for the wonderful invitation. Obviously, it's a big challenge to follow Professor Jay's. It's also wonderful to see my mentor, Professor Marshlinsky here, to be a tiny little leaf on his tree is quite an honor. And especially with reference to Dr. Jay's, we've seen incredible information about the new ablation technologies, but of course we need to know where to ablate. And I think that's no more true in any area than it is in persistent AF. And also recalling the work, great speech by Dr. Frontera, the idea of looking at conduction velocity as opposed to simple voltage, it seems to be a key way that we are approaching things and how might we apply this to the atrium as well as to the ventricle. Disclosures. Certainly the AFib, persistent AFib patient is a great challenge. None of you in the room need to know this. There really has not been a tremendous amount of improvement in how we've done with them over the past decade. And when we have attempted to identify areas of critical arrhythmogenic substrate to target in persistent AF patients, we've run into challenges as well, showing only really modest improvement as we've gone along beyond pulmonary vein antral isolation, which remains the core of what's done for these patients. And the hypothesis that I'm going to raise is that our understanding really has been limited by the lack of tools capable of detailed entire chamber interrogation of the atrium in persistent AF patients. So, and I think there are some limitations of our current mapping techniques and technologies. High-density contact mapping, of course, is key to what we've been doing for many of our patients. But the reality is that these catheters that are being used require you to stitch together small patches of activation information over time throughout the construction of an atrial electrical map. That means that we have very limited understanding of the entire chamber all at once. And of course, that's going to be very necessary in a patient who has persistent AF, where you have a multitude of different wavefronts moving throughout the entire chamber all at the same time. Furthermore, if you want to do more work beyond just the initial mapping, it's quite time consuming, et cetera, to build these maps. And that, in reality, does get in the way of our procedures. In addition, the biophysics of contact mapping, especially with bipolar catheters, no matter how small the electrode spacing, you're still limited by the far field attributes of that and the far field attributes of voltage mapping without going into too much of the biophysics. And even if the catheters, again, have very small spacing of their electrodes, you still have limited ability to have resolution when you talk about looking at the front wavefront of activation. You might see very detailed information about voltage in a particular spot, that's different than looking at wavefront activation. Therefore, again, limited ability to see repeated patterns in these unstable arrhythmias. And really, the tools that we have so far are best suited to looking at and interrogating more stable arrhythmias that can be mapped over time throughout a chamber that have larger areas of wavefront to look at. And so this is a technology many of you may be familiar with, some less so, some more so. This is the AcuMap catheter by the Acutus company. And importantly, in addition to being a very sort of pretty piece of industrial artwork, it has some unique characteristics. As far as anatomical mapping, this catheter has 48 ultrasound crystals on it, which allows for really rapid attainment of ultrasound information. Up to 115,000 points per minute can be created to allow you to create full chamber anatomy in a very rapid way. Currently, using this tool, we get the two-dimensional shell that we're all used to. I will mention that there's going to be some things that are not yet approved that we'll talk about later on in the talk. But probably more importantly, initially anyway, is as far as electrophysiology mapping, it also has 48 low impedance electrodes allow for non-contact dipole density mapping, which allows you to capture as many as 150,000 intracardiac unipolar voltage samples per second while you're working with this catheter, allowing you to get immediate full chamber high density representation of both stable and unstable arrhythmias. Now, part of the key here, and without going into too much of the biophysics of all this, is that dipole density mapping has fundamental differences than the typical bipolar voltage mapping that we're used to looking at. And the bottom line, without going through all the biophysics, is that once you have measured the voltage like we typically do, and then you do the inverse solution of the Poisson equation to actually look at localized charge density, you're able to see the propagation of the wavefront on the surface in a way that is much more accurate and with, in a sense, smaller pixel size than we're able to see when we use bipolar contact mapping catheters, typically on the order of 4 times more information than we get with bipolar mapping, and therefore 4 times more specific as far as the area of tissue that we are able to interrogate. A lot of it because we have a much better ability to get rid of the far field electrical activity. And so what does this allow us to do? This allows the system to be capable of simultaneous mapping of the entire chamber all at once, and with resolution that can be as high as 4 times greater than what we can see with any of our bipolar voltage mapping contact catheters. And so this is some of the information we can get. This is just an example. This is actually an organized mitral flutter. But to give you an idea, we can see very detailed movement of this wavefront as it goes around the mitral valve. This is 2 minutes and 30 seconds of mapping and interrogation that allows for the collection of millions of points of data within a very short period of time. In comparison to one of the contact force high-density catheters that we're used to working with, where you might take 15 minutes to map the chamber, and granted you have a very large number of electrograms that are measured, but the reality is that one tiny point next to another as far as wavefront interrogation is actually, again, limited by the far field information you're getting from a bipolar contact catheter. And so what happens when we start, when we compare, are these, is this information that we're getting real? And I think that's going to be always one of the questions people have. This is not the non-contact mapping that we had from 15 years ago with ESIRA. This is a whole new generation, just like your flip phone is not the same as your iPhone 11, okay? And there is very good published data. This is actually very recently published, again, showing the validity of the fact that these non-contact points of data really do have excellent correlation to what you get with contact mapping. So what you're seeing is real. And when you apply this to patients who have persistent AF, you start to see some patterns that emerge. And again, this is very early on, and nobody involved with this is going to tell you that we have the answers to what you're supposed to look for in persistent AF. But again, we're starting to see some patterns emerge that are very interesting. The first, and see if the video will play a little faster, is you get these focal bursts of activation that seem to show up in about a third of the times that you interrogate persistent AF. We also have localized rotational activation, in this case being defined not as a full rotation, but 270-degree repetitive rotation around a single region. And probably most importantly in this case, and this is a new idea that I think gets this idea of wavefront conduction velocity in general, are these areas of what we might call localized irregular activation. It's not necessarily rotational, it's not necessarily focal, but you see localization of all of that. You see slow conduction through the region, you see a bit of rotation, you see some automated firing as well, but it seems to cluster in these regions repetitively in these patients. And these are the areas that we are beginning to look at as far as being of interest in how to target patients with persistent AF. And so to look at this in a clinical study, the Uncover AF study, which was published this past year, is a prospective single-arm, multi-center, multinational study done in Europe and in Canada. And it's non-randomized, single-arm, looking at this technology in persistent AF patients. You're looking at both safety and efficacy, and with outcomes that include 6 and 12 months, freedom from documented episodes of arrhythmia, post-ablation, both on and off antiarrhythmic drugs. Patient population, total number, not huge, but a reasonable number, 127 patients treated. We have full year data on 121 of them, and a fairly typical population of persistent AF patients as well, many of which have had several years' worth of AF, the average being 2 years of AF by the time that they were treated. The procedure process includes building the ultrasound anatomy, which I mentioned before, we'll take a quick look at later. If the patient's in sinus rhythm, they actually induced atrial fibrillation. So we're able to map in atrial fibrillation. Then create this map of the activation that I showed you before and look at that for those patterns. Basically looking at 5-second segments of atrial fibrillation to try and identify these patterns. Every patient did have PVI performed, and then ablation was performed to target these particular patterns. Not just one pattern or another, not just focal, not just rotational, not just the irregular activity, but all of those patterns when they met those criteria. Then after that ablation was performed, if the patient remained in atrial fibrillation, to reinterrogate again with another map. And again, the beauty of this is it takes 1 to 2 minutes to make another map, okay? There's not 15 minutes of additional mapping that needs to go on. 1 to 2 minutes, make another map, take a look again for these patterns, ablate further if you find patterns, then repeat. And patients had up to 4 iterations of mapping and ablation performed until either they had no more identifiable patterns identified, they converted to sinus rhythm, or to a flutter. That was the protocol. And at the end, as long as there was nothing else to be done, they either were converted to sinus rhythm if they hadn't been ablated back to sinus rhythm. This is an example, then, of what you tend to find in some of these patients. First, I'll focus you on this right-hand panel, a posterior view, and an area that seems to have very interesting activity. What you'll see is that this patient starts with this localized rotational activity around this area in a counterclockwise fashion. In fact, there are 6 beats of this that occur as we're watching. And again, this is all developed in real time in a 2-minute map, okay? Then you'll see conduction across the septum, which extinguishes by running into that wavefront. You get electrical chaos for a few moments. And then we're going to see that there's going to be focal firing, again, from a location very similar to this. Boom, 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 okay? Which then actually leads to a period of this localized irregular activity. Again, we see some localized firing, we see a bit of rotational movement, we see slow meandering of conduction through this area, okay? Similarly, if you look at the anterior wall in this patient, they also have this area where you have a grouping of activity, slow conduction, meandering in and out. It's not necessarily rotational, it's not necessarily focal firing, but again, you have this slow conduction in varying directions, what this local irregular activity that we're talking about. So again, a very interesting way of interrogating, and I think this is not something we've ever really seen before, right? How many of you have been able to visualize this before in real time in a patient with persistent AF? So when you do these ablations based upon this, we got reasonable results. We have 6-month freedom from AFib or ATAC in the 70 to 80% range, by 9 months and 12 months down in the 70% range. Obviously far from perfect, but this is the very beginning of how we're beginning to understand this. And if you look at AF burden overall, again, concerning the patients had persistent AF for 2 years on average, they did extremely well with a marked reduction in AF burden. Interestingly, when you look at some of the predictors of how well the patients did, the more of these targets that were ablated, the better the patients did. If you found 3 different targets to ablate based on these algorithms, there's a 9-fold improvement in patient clinical outcome. If there are 2 different pattern types that you found, there was almost a 3-fold improvement in clinical outcome. And of course, the patients who showed up in sinus rhythm did better overall, probably just had less sick atrium. But certainly very interesting here to suggest that if you can target these spots, you might be on to something as far as improving clinical outcome. And if you compare to similar trials in persistent AF patients, then again, this has to be taken with a huge grain of salt because there were significant differences in how the patients were followed up as far as the intensity of post-procedure monitoring, et cetera. We're certainly in the ballpark. And again, with the STAR trials in particular suggesting that going beyond pulmonary vein isolation really contributed little or nothing to this, where we may actually be able to see some improvement over that in this very early work. So in conclusion, the use of this system with an iterative mapping adaptive therapy approach did result in approximately 70% AF-free single procedure effectiveness at 12 months, which is compares reasonably well to existing trials. Again, small study, limited endpoint monitoring. But these initial results do suggest that this is really worth pursuing. Okay? And in addition, it leads me to think about what else might this technology be able to show us. And now to shift a bit to what we were talking about before, can sinus rhythm substrate mapping of the atrium now, not the ventricle, contribute to our understanding? Can we treat AF somewhat like we've been treating VT? And so to perform these maps in sinus rhythm or differential pacing, can we analyze that and see something about the underlying functional substrate of the atrium? Okay, and this is certainly enhanced by using differential pacing as well. And then if we compare these zones of interest developed through the sinus rhythm and pacing drive maps with what goes on during arrhythmia, can we then have a better understanding of the underlying physiology in order to target our ablations? And again, the beauty is we can recreate these maps in a minute or two every time we want during the procedure. And so this is a very interesting example of a patient having a third ablation procedure. This is actually a single beat mapped in sinus rhythm. And there's two areas I'll draw your attention to. One is this region right here where you see some stacked isochrones. And again, what you're looking at here is wavefront propagation, this the idea of velocity. And when you see stacked isochrones, you see areas of slow conduction. Okay? So that is a small area here that seems to be of interest. And then on the posterior wall, we see that actually that there's a bit of clockwise rotational activity around this area right here. Again, for orientation, posterior wall, this is actually the left-sided pulmonary veins, right-sided ones around the corner there, left atrial appendage over there. Okay, so this kind of clockwise rotational activity. We also see quite a bit of disjunction between anterior and posterior wall as far as how long it takes the signal to get from one to the other, indicating some delay in conduction across the roof as well. Now we've gone from sinus rhythm to pacing in the coronary sinus, okay, the mid-coronary sinus. And interestingly, when you look at the anterior wall, you've actually lost that zone of slow conduction. You have a parallel wavefront, I think, working its way up along that functional zone of slow conduction that actually does not show slow conduction any longer. Again, it points to the fact that just because you see something in one rhythm doesn't mean it's always there in another, that this is a functional issue here. But interestingly, when you look at the posterior wall, you actually see a little bit of opposite. Now, counterclockwise rotational activity a bit, again, around this similar zone here. Now, this is where it gets even more interesting, is if you pace at 300 milliseconds, you now, and again, we're only looking at one beat, so you're not seeing multiple beats, but this is a 300 millisecond time interval for pacing. We now, again, see some further slow conduction and a bit of rotation in this anterior region, and even more interesting, in the posterior region, we see slow conduction around this area, and what appears to be the beginnings of a figure of eight reentry in this patient, okay? So we're certainly learning something about this patient's functional anatomy in real time here. And then when we look at atrial fibrillation, we see that both of these areas are of interest, okay? We seem to have some meandering, irregular activity that takes place here, okay? As well as even more impressively on this posterior wall where we see some counterclockwise rotational activity, we see slow meandering of this electrical activity, this irregular electrical activity through this area here. Again, as this is a 5-second interval of atrial fibrillation. So we're able to interrogate this repetitively, not based on just a single beat. But again, we can see the entire chamber for each of those beats. And I think we're really learning something unique about this. Now, what this means in the long run, still a lot more work to do. But again, I would posit to you that we've never been able to interrogate the atrium like this before. And in this particular patient, ablation was performed in these regions after pulmonary vein isolation had been completed. They needed to touch up the veins a little bit, at which point the patient converted into a regular atrial flutter, okay? And again, just the quick map of 1 minute, able to say, you know what, this is actually entering over here on the low septum. The entire cycle length is not represented in the left atrium. This is actually right atrial flutter. Okay, and the patient ablated back to sinus rhythm. Okay, so again, we're able to interrogate the atrium in a new way with this technology that I think is very exciting. I'm going to shift again real quick just to talk about the anatomy now, the ultrasound anatomy. So this is an example of how the anatomy is created. You turn on the ultrasound crystals, you spin the catheter around, and in just a couple of minutes, you create a two-dimensional ultrasound anatomy. Very efficient. It's real anatomy as well, unlike our contact-based anatomies where you're pushing out the tissue wall and you have to hand that anatomy to your mapper to put it on a rotisserie and actually shave away areas that aren't real. You subject that to human error every single time you make a map. This is real anatomy and can be recreated at any point during the procedure. But I think what's coming down the pike is even more interesting. Those are the first-order ultrasound reflections, okay? And this is not quite ready for prime time yet, but this is imaging demonstrating something about tissue characteristics? Are we going to be able to see ultrasound representation of underlying substrate? Are we going to know for the very first time how thick the tissue is that we want to ablate in the atrium? Are we going to know that we should put a 4-millimeter lesion here when the tissue is 4 millimeter instead of a 6-millimeter lesion near where the esophagus is, or 2-millimeter lesion in a location where it might look good from inflammation, but then you have reoccurrence? Even more interesting is this. This is real-time atrial wall motion. Okay, and maybe Dr. Jays and Dr. Marshlinsky know what to do with this now, but I certainly don't, okay? But I think there'll be some very interesting stuff to be done with this later on, okay? And so this is the beginning, really, of learning about this fascinating new technology. And this is very early. This is actually some animal work in the ventricle. But here we have complete electrofunctional diagnostics all in one place. We have real-time wall motion. We have ability to indicate where the ventricle is contracting and relaxing at once, and to map on top of that real-time single-beat electrical activity. Okay. So again, I don't know for sure that this is going to change the world, but there is information here that is unique and I think is very much worth pursuing. And the final thing I'll mention is this, and I showed this slide before, but I did want to focus on the fact of how much data is being collected. Okay? This is a tremendous amount of data. If you have several million points collected in 100 patients, I don't know how to do the math, but there's trillions of data points there in a way that we've never had before. What does happen when you hand that to Google or somebody capable of doing big-time data analytics? Are we going to be able to look at AF patients in a brand new way and really be able to derive some information out of what appears to be chaos in a way that we never could before? So in conclusion, I think that we're seeing here a powerful tool that's really just at the beginning of our understanding, that high-definition, full-chamber dipole density mapping does provide a unique way of visualizing the atrium in patients with persistent AFib. And then early clinical studies do suggest that we might be onto something as far as improving our patient outcomes, but there's still a long way to go. And that additional real-time sinus rhythm analysis of the tissue substrate may also be able to contribute to our understanding as well in a way that we've never had before, and somewhat parallel to the work that we've been doing in the ventricle. And finally, as I just mentioned, the profound quantity of data may let us use big-time data analytics in a way that we've never used before as well to understand these arrhythmias in a better way. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it, and for the invitation.
Thank you very much for this marvelous talk and these marvelous pictures. And Hans, I think you are predestined to discuss this.
Yeah, I have some questions or some doubts, to be honest. Sure. When we look to mapping of Maurits Alessi, high density contact mapping simultaneously endoepicardial during intraoperative mapping. On small scale, you see very, very complex activation, very, very epi, endo, breakthrough, and so on. When I see your swipers during atrial fibrillation, it is by 10 dimensions more simple, the activation. How can you explain this enormous difference?
Sure. Well, I think all of it's going on at once, right? I mean, there's no question that we have, you know, micromillimeter, you know, probably myocardial cell-to-cell level irregular activation in AFib, right? On the other hand, there are also clearly going to be patches or areas of the tissue that do show evidence of substrate functional abnormality. And, you know, I don't think we're ever going to be able to target things on the level that you're seeing with the mapping that you're describing. On the other hand, if we can identify patches of true substrate, we might be able to have some impact. I'm under no, you know, illusions that we're going to cure persistent AFib. Okay, I don't think that's probably in the cards, right? But, you know, can we identify zones of slow and irregular conduction in a way that we've never seen before that may be able to improve those patients' outcomes? So, you know, I actually agree with you that we're still a long way from being able to see the level that you're talking about. On the other hand, with this tool, we're able to see a level that is far beyond what we can see with our contact mapping dipole catheters that, again, are limited by far field, et cetera. So I think we're probably somewhere in the middle between the contact mapping dipole catheters that we have now, where, again, you have to stitch together the entire atrium, and in doing so, you can never see the whole atrium all at once. Right, and then sort of the ultimate, which would be, you know, micro level analysis, right? So I agree with you, and I think that this is just one step forward, but I don't know, I'm not arguing that it's the answer.
I may just add that, of course, we have seen some ideal examples, for example, the three patterns you have shown from the Uncover trial, and of course, we frequently encounter a mixture of different patterns, and also this pattern of localized irregular activity is just an explanation for a region where we could not maybe really sort out what is exactly going on. And of course, there is a kind of simplification and summation of the effects, and that's of course a part of the system and part how it is distributed and shown. So
yes.
Of course, not everything Maurice Alessi can see, and not everything you can see with a high-density contact mapping is maybe visualized, but it's an option. As you said, we don't know if this is the clue for everything, of course, but it's an option to get an impression of the simultaneous activation at once. And that's I think, one interesting part. And the second, maybe, to add that, is that we could show that these patterns are reproducible. So the Cologne group did this on this study on reproduction. So if you go there again, a couple of minutes later, you again see these patterns. So it's not just by chance and just on a it's unstable at the it may be unstable in the region, but the regions are, or it's confined to the region, and you come back to that site and you see it again there.
And I would add to that, that if you then see those same regions with sinus rhythm and with differential pacing, that you also have some understanding that there's some underlying substrate there that leads to this irregular activity. And I'd also point out that this is much less focused on some prior technologies that have come out, which were entirely focused on the rotational activity. Right? I think this localized irregular activity is actually going to be the dominant signal that we're seeing, is just that there's substrate here, right?
And you point out the enormous amount of mapping points, but it's not mapping points, and you say you don't call it mapping points because it is calculated. It's inverse solution mathematics. So you have your tool, your basket, or however you call it, I don't know, and then you calculate to the endocardium. No? And we always have to stress that point. This is not high density mapping like what we call mapping. It's calculations. It's inverse solution mathematics. And I really, when I see what happens on a microscopic scale during the contact mapping, what Alessi does, I have enormous doubts that you come even close to what really happens during atrial fibrillation with inverse solution mathematics.
Well, I don't know that that's going to be the case. I understand what you're saying, but I agree. You need to define these things better. What you're seeing instead is a high definition of where that wavefront activation is moving through the tissue. And that's a different thing than saying we have high definition mapping points of voltage. I agree. That's completely different. So this is not obtaining that.
Last question with respect to the endpoint of your extrapulmonary vein ablation. What is your endpoint of that ablation that you do?
So at this point, we are iterating through the ablation until we don't see any more of these patterns. So if you interrogate for a 5-second period of time, you don't see any more obvious patterns, then you quit. Yes, sir.
There's one more question.
Do you train artificial intelligence systems with this amount of data?
Say that again.
Do you train AI systems with this amount of data?
Well, I think that's exactly the question, is do you train AI systems with this amount of data? And that was exactly the point I was trying to make at the end there, which is that I think it would be very interesting to look at that, right? That is not yet been done. And I think that if you feed this tremendous amount of data into high quality data analytics that can handle that amount of data, of course, garbage in, garbage out, right? So I think we have to understand that what these points are and what they are not, right? But, you know, if we are able to interrogate that much data from a reasonable number of patients and apply that to some type of machine learning AI, then again, I think we might be able to see something in these very difficult to take care of patients that we've not seen before. And after a decade of frustration and trying to figure out what to do with these people, I think that's a welcome thing.
I may just add that during the Uncover trial, we did this, of course, manually or with your individual characterization of the areas, but there are algorithms in development that help you to discern between the different patterns and to show this in a more intuitive way. So this is really, of course, a work in progress and some kind of automatism will be introduced by the newer software versions. I'm sure about that.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, again, not quite ready for prime time, and with a intention of the corporate interest to avoid being able to tell us where to ablate, right? But obviously, ways to display this data in a more understandable fashion to humans. We can't wrap our heads around 55 million points. I mean, that's not, you know, it's impossible, right? And so how do we display that in a way that becomes useful to us is certainly very much what they're talking about. That's right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.